All right, it's the morning after here in Geneva. Last night was the Grand Prix d'Horlogerie de Genève, or the GPHG. These are the biggest awards in watchmaking, sometimes called the Oscars of watchmaking. And our own Jack Forrester was on the jury for the second time, and I got to attend for the very first time. So we thought it would be good to sit down just a couple hours after the show, the sun is barely up, and we're sitting in Jack's hotel room, to record a little bit of a recap, to talk through the watches that won, the watches that didn't win, what trends we noticed, and kind of the state of the awards overall. I'm your host, Stephen Pulverant, and this is Hodinkee Radio. This week's episode is brought to you by Hook and Albert. Stay tuned later in the show to learn more about this global travel brand and their range of travel accessories. You can also learn more at hookandalbert.com. All right, good to be here with you, Jack. Thanks for doing this.
Well, thank you for putting this all together, Stephen.
For sure. I know you've had a long couple of days, so it's, you know what, it's about 12 hours, I guess, after the award ceremony ended. We're sitting here in your room at the Kempinski Hotel in Geneva.
Yes.
Scenic,
yes.
Lovely, I guess, sort of gray Geneva.
Yeah, it's been kind of classic Geneva weather all week. I think I've seen the sun maybe for 45 minutes.
But that's kind of appropriate, right, for this week.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's perfect. It puts you in exactly the right mood for voting on watches.
So, you know, we'll get into the awards themselves. I know people probably want to hear our thoughts on who won, who didn't win. But I thought before we do that, we could get into kind of the process and the politics of all of this.
Mm-hmm.
This is your second year as a juror for the GPHG, right?
That's right. That's right.
And so what's that process like? You've been in Geneva since what? Last Sunday? You've been here almost
a
week.
Yeah, I got in on a fairly early Sunday morning. And the way that the week plays out if you're a juror is you come in on a Sunday afternoon or a very early Monday morning, and we go over to a museum here in Geneva where all of the watches are laid out, not in vitrines, but they're laid out as they were for sort of the exhibitions that the GPHG has been having, the traveling exhibition that they have. So we get a chance to get acquainted, reacquainted with the watches for the first time. We get a chance to actually look at them in the metal, to handle them, and then everybody sits down. And the way that it works is we're broken into three groups, and just because it would be unwieldy for 20 plus people to try to have a productive group discussion.
Yeah, sure.
With that many people providing input, so we break up into three groups, and each group gets a tray full of watches in a particular category. So if I'm in Group A, we get all of the ladies' watches, all of the candidates for best ladies' watch, and we look at them, and we cast our ballots. For which one we think is the best. And then the same process takes place at the other two tables. And we just sort of go round robin all day.
What's that examination process like, right? Like you have the watches on a tray in front of you. I assume there's some nice loops there and decent lighting.
The light's pretty good. Loops are provided by Loop System, which is fantastic.
Very nice.
It gives us an opportunity to look at the watches through, some of the best optical glass in the loop business, which is pretty fantastic. So thanks to them for that. And it's very, the actual evaluation process is very unstructured. The GPHG as an organization assumes that people who are going to be, or they try to select, for jurors, people who have a high degree of expertise and a high degree of understanding of watches. And they feel that we're all sort of professionals, so we don't need to be told what to look for, which is generally speaking true. I mean, when you have people the caliber of Philippe Dufour, on the jury, and he's somebody, by the way, who people are very comfortable with asking for advice when it comes to evaluating movement finishing, for example.
I mean, he kind of knows a little bit.
He might know a little bit. Yeah. But the whole thing is essentially fairly unstructured. People are very, very. I would say comfortable with asking each other, for opinions. And there's a lot of tolerance for varying opinions, and opinions do vary. One of the things that I was very surprised by last year is, I was sort of surprised by the whole thing because it was my first year as a juror. So, everything was new. But it's a genuine sort of opinion driven evaluation process. I mean, everybody has their favorites. Everybody has things that they absolutely love and absolutely hate. You know, everybody's there because they have strong feelings about watches. I mean, as you know, there are, you know, a lot of people get into writing about watches kind of by accident, like I did.
Right.
So you have a lot of people who were, you know, enthusiasts, were passionate about watches first before getting involved with them professionally. But you also have, you know, you also have retailers. Kimi Favempe is there, who is, again, somebody who might be presumed to know a little bit about watches.
Sure. Yeah. I think that's a safe bet.
Yeah. You know, we just go around all day, kind of arguing amongst ourselves and discussing amongst ourselves and asking for views and opinions when something comes up that we don't understand or that we think we could use some insight on. So, for example, I consider myself pretty okay on the technical side of watches and watchmaking, and, you know, not bad when it comes to evaluating movement finishing, but in terms of I wouldn't be your go-to guy for looking at a gem set watch and saying, okay, these are top quality diamonds, this is a top quality setting, you know, et cetera, and so forth. But there are people there, like Mr. Siddiqui from Dubai, who really do know that particular subject extremely well. So, you know, we tend to go to, you know, somebody like that, for instance, you know, for sort of advice on how to evaluate the quality of a stone.
Sure. And I mean, you mentioned that there are debates and definitely some disagreements. I know you can't give us, you know, all the juicy details with names and everything. I know that would violate the confidentiality of the deliberation process.
Yeah. It's true. One of the things that the folks at the GPHG really do take great care to emphasize is the need for confidentiality about the deliberation process. So, I will say this, though, for anybody who's interested in watches and watchmaking, it would be an amazing experience to be a fly on the wall in that room, because what you're hearing are unfiltered opinions from people who have been, in many cases, involved with watches and fine watchmaking their entire lives. And boy, oh boy, do they have views.
Without using names, were there any like particular disagreements or sorts of disagreements that kind of stood out to you this year as being sort of like arguments of note?
You know, the big thing I would say, and this is I don't think this is something that will necessarily surprise anybody who's kind of looks at the comments on Houdinki or the comments on other watch websites, or you know, goes to, you know, watch events and talks to other watch enthusiasts. I think the main dichotomy is really between people who are evaluating watches from what they, you know, consider to be a sort of like hard watchmaking perspective, and those who are evaluating a watch who are more motivated by, you know, sort of the design elements of a watch. And you know, there are obviously watches that lend themselves more to, you know, a technical evaluation, and watches that lend themselves more to an aesthetic evaluation. You know, I mean, if you're looking at you know, a really, really beautiful gem set ladies watch. You know, there was a cuff watch by Piaget that, you know, kind of wowed everybody because of the intricacy and beauty of the design and the gem setting. But it's quartz-powered watch, so that's not something you're going to look at and, you know, say to yourself, let's evaluate this on a sort of technical watchmaking basis. But there are watches where it's a little bit less clear how you should evaluate them. The Singer, for instance, you know, like I look at the Singer Reimagined, which has a movement from designed by Jean-Marc Wiedericht, who just retired this year, by the way.
The Agenor, right?
The Agenor. What do they call it? The Agengraf, which has...
Good name.
Yeah. Which has a lot of really cool technical solutions in it. And that's a really difficult watch to evaluate because stylistically, it's not like, you know, pretty much any other chronograph out there. I mean, it shares some configuration similarities with the Fabergé version of the Agengraf chronograph just because they're using the same movement, so the pushers are right in the same place. And the dial is designed to support a certain read-off of the chronograph times. So, you know, there's some basic layout similarities, but like you look at the Singer Reimagined and, you know, you sort of say to yourself, that's a watch where you can love or you can like it or dislike it on a lot of different levels. You can love the technical solutions in the movement for their ingenuity. You can dislike them because you sort of say to you prefer a traditional lateral clutch chronograph, you know, for whatever reason. You can love the aesthetics. You know, it's a very kind of like, not steampunk. There should be a word in watchmaking for like the equivalent of steampunk, but for like 1950s watch design.
Yeah, there should be actually.
You know, so it's kind of a nostalgia piece. You know, it's got that sort of pseudo bullhead configuration for the pushers, and the colors are very sort of like 1960s racetrack, you know, sports chronograph. So there's a lot of ways in which you can like and dislike it, and it's not a straightforward process to evaluate a watch like that at all. Once you start getting into the granular details, and you know, as you can imagine, you know, with a group of jurors, you know, like we have, the conversation gets granular pretty much instantly.
Yeah.
You know, when you are looking at a watch like that and really discussing it on a granular level, I mean, we could have almost spent the entire day just, you know, debating the finer points of that, you know, one particular watch, and we've got, you know, 70 odd watches to get through, so we don't have
right.
the luxury of doing that.
Yeah, so you're not sequestered, but you're essentially all kind of like, you know, pushed into this room, sat around tables, you have the watches.
Right.
You're spending a couple of hours doing this, and you have to make decisions on all of these categories and kind of figure all of this out relatively quickly, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's an all-day process, actually. The GPHG asks us to get there at 8:30 in the morning because everybody dicks around and has... Oh, pardon me. I thought Ben had the monopoly on being a potty mouth on the podcast. but yeah, you know, they know that everybody's going to, you know, want to chit-chat because, you know, we all know each other, but we don't see each other that often, and certainly not en masse. So everybody gets together at 8:30 in the morning, and you know, we all have coffee and gossip, and you know, people say hello enthusiastically to old friends and look askance at ancient enemies, and then we all
so
sit
it's
down
so
and,
it's a watch event. Is
yeah,
what
you're
oh my gosh,
me. Yeah, 100%, 100%. Only you know, like I mean, you know, turned up to 11.
And then you guys, when you come out at the end of the day, nobody knows who's won, right?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. You know, we how late we go depends on how heated the debate gets about the big prizes, which are decided at the end. So, you know, the Aiguille d'Or, for instance, the last, that's basically the last, you know, sort of prize we figure out. We
and that's,
special
that's
jury
essentially
prize
the
that.
Grand prize, the
exactly.
best watch of the year,
exactly.
right?
Exactly. Yeah. And that's almost, you know, it gets to the end of the day. And basically the only criteria, the only official criteria for the Aiguille d'Or is which watch out of these, all of these dozens and dozens of watches, which one did you think was the best? So you can imagine...
That's sufficiently vague.
Yeah, exactly.
Are most of the category descriptions that vague, or are you given kind of, you know, for best men's watch, are you given parameters, or is it literally just like, if you were a man, which watch would you want?
Yeah, you know, like the best men's watch and best ladies' watch categories, you know, these are really, really weird things to kind of evaluate nowadays. I mean, I think when there was a sort of, you know, if you come at it from the, you know, traditional notions of the gendered watch, right? Like a men's watch is, you know, what's a men's watch? Well, it's probably stainless steel. It's likelier than not to be on a bracelet, although not necessarily. You know, it's probably not smaller than 38 millimeters nowadays. You know, I mean, 36 in the 50s, but, you know, 38 plus nowadays with a relatively straightforward dial design. You know, it says unassuming masculinity, essentially, you know, whatever like masculinity is. And then, you know, best ladies watch. These are really watches that, you know, in the Swiss watch industry, the dichotomy between what's traditionally thought of as a men's watch and traditionally what's thought of a lady's watch is institutionalized in a lot of different ways. Everything from the basic conceptualization and design process all the way down to, you know, sort of tooling and machining. I mean, if you want to make, you know, I mean, a lot of these companies and a lot of their factories are actually set up in terms of like hard production capabilities, you know, like what goes on an assembly line, what tooling you use, what materials you use, what you order from suppliers. You know, the whole industry is set up on a certain level around this like dichotomy that no longer, that doesn't necessarily obtain anymore, at least not in the way that it did, you know, in the 50s, 60s, you know, well, I would say, you know, up until the, you know, the beginning of the 2000s. And, you know, like there are, you know, a lot of men that we know who prefer watches that would not have been thought sufficiently masculine in terms of size.
Sure.
You know, today, I mean, you know, I have had several 36 millimeter watches. I don't think I would feel comfortable with a watch smaller than 36 millimeters just because I have a 7-inch wrist, you know, but it's not because I have some notion that there's a certain minimum size for a watch to be masculine.
Sure.
It's just, it's just what's comfortable for me. And, you know, I mean, I've seen women wearing Panerais, you know, as a sort of a style statement.
Yeah.
And it looks great. And, you know, generally speaking, lady watch enthusiasts that you and I know, they tend to want the same things that guys do because, like, a good watch is a good watch is a good watch.
Right.
But when we're presented with these watches and we sort of, you know, to answer your question, which I'm getting to in an extremely roundabout fashion.
That's fine. I expect that, Jack. I know you. I expect that.
It's the there's sort of an assumption that once any of the watch experts who are on the jury walk into a particular category that, you know, we've had so much exposure we're sort of equipped to make an evaluation without any of, you know, what the GPHG might perceive as hand-holding. So the men's watches, they're a very, very disparate bunch of watches. We had the Acrivia Chronometre Contemporain. We had a De Bethune. We had a Moser, the Endeavor Flying Hours, which is a very cool watch. It's always nice to see a Wandering Hours complication. The MB&F Legacy Machine Split Escapement, the Vacheron Constantin Historique Triple Calendar 1942, and a gorgeous piece, by the ever reliable for making gorgeous pieces, Kari Voutilainen. But, you look at these watches and, okay, they all kind of generally fit in a very, very, in an extremely general way.
That is a very broad set of watches.
A lot of these pieces have almost nothing to do with each other than the fact that they're a certain size. I mean, we've got precious metal. We've got a gold watch with the Acrivia. We have the MB&F and the De Bethune, which, take a sort of, not maximalist approach to watchmaking, but there's I think that
they're a little more over the top.
Yeah, exactly. We have the Vacheron, which is, a straight shot of classic mid-century, men's complicated watchmaking.
A watch that our own Ben Clymer has.
Yeah. Ben actually has the original version. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I was actually with Ben in Geneva when he went to pick it up. I was with Revolution at the time.
Nice.
We took a walk up the hill to Christie's, and I had a chance to congratulate him on picking that one up. The Vacheron and the Voutilainen arguably are closer to each other than any of the other watches. The Acrivia kind of stands alone as an exercise in I know you love that watch.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a minute, but I'm pretty crazy about that watch.
It's an exercise in basically beauty from a movement standpoint. Not that it doesn't have a very, sort of Augustan dial. I think that he really kind of, hit a home run in terms of dial design with
completely.
This one. But that's a watch where, the party's all in the back.
Yeah.
But, as you can see, just looking at this particular category, here are these six watches. They don't have a whole heck of a lot to do with each other.
No. I mean, we're looking at them on your laptop right now, and they have almost nothing to do with each other except for the fact that they are ostensibly marketed to be worn by men.
Right. And round.
So the long and short of it then, I guess, is you're not given a whole lot of instruction. You're basically told, here's the name of the category. Make your best call. We trust you.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
I mean, that's... I think in some ways there's a lot to be said for that, you kind of just, they make their selection when they select the jury, and from there it's up to you guys.
And, by the same token, we can look at the ladies' watches. And again, not a whole lot to connect them.
That's true.
So what do we have here? We look at the ladies' pieces and we've got all nice in their own way, but again, pretty different.
We have Bove, yeah. Bulgari, Chanel, mm-hmm. Chaumet, Moritz Grossman and Piaget. That's a motley crew if there ever was one.
Right. And, we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 round watches, 1 square, 2 skeletonized pieces, 1, sort of technical piece.
All 6 with diamonds, of course.
All 6 with diamonds. The Grossman has diamonds, but very, very discreet. The
Bulgari has diamonds, but very not discreet.
Extremely
not discreet.
Yeah, extremely not discreet. Yeah, c'est une montre indiscrète.
Oh.
I hope I said that right.
Your French was good last night.
Yeah, I was reading it off the envelope, but thanks.
That's, I'll give you credit anyway.
These are watches that don't have a whole heck of a lot to do with each other. The one element they have in common is diamonds, but the Grossman, certainly that's not where the sale is.
Yeah,
that's
for sure.
Not the thing that closes the deal on that particular
for
watch.
Sure. So, I don't want to keep people waiting too much longer. And since we're now getting kind of into the minutiae, I thought we would just go through the categories one by one.
Sure.
We'll go through them in the order that they were presented in last night, which changes year to year. And I thought we would just go through. We'll go over the winners. I think people probably know who they are by now. If not, we'll link it up in the show notes for this. We ran a full recap immediately after the awards ended.
Mm-hmm.
I was presenting it live on Instagram stories, so we've got ways for you to see all of these watches.
Right.
But let's just go through the categories.
Okay.
Talk about the winners and talk about maybe who didn't win and why, and get kind of into some of the controversy, because I think there was definitely some controversy.
Yeah. It's actually hard for me to tell because, you know, our deliberations do take place in a kind of, you know, sequestered atmosphere. But I am actually pretty curious to hear from you where you thought some of the where there might have been room for difference of opinion.
Yeah, totally.
And, you know, given Watch People, there's room for difference of opinion absolutely everywhere. But
absolutely.
Know, let's get into it.
Yeah, and I mean, just so people know, this event is held in a theater underneath the Kempinski Hotel.
Right.
It's sort of like red velvet seats, like very traditional kind of theater atmosphere.
Right.
And literally everybody from the Watch world is there. You know,
yeah.
Everyone who we do business with and who we see, quite a few people who you've already heard here on Houdinki Radio are in this room.
Now there are some significant absences too, which we'll get to
that's,
in a minute.
That's true. But it's probably the largest gathering of Watch folks outside of Basel World, maybe.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, it's a pretty big theater. I'm not sure exactly what the seating is, but it's not small. I mean,
and
there are an awful lot of heavy hitters from the industry there. A lot of heavy hitters from the sort of global horological press there, style editors, design editors. It's definitely not a All-Star Ran kind of event as far as the industry is concerned. And, you know, here in Geneva, which for justifiable reason still sees itself as kind of the world capital of fine watchmaking.
Sure.
You know, in Geneva, it's a huge deal. Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
All right. So let's get into it.
Okay. So do you want to, should we...
Let's start we'll go with, in the order in which they were presented.
Okay.
So up first was the Challenge Prize, which is a new prize. And that's for watches under what price?
Retail price under 4,000 Swiss. And smartwatches are admissible in this category.
Right. Which we covered this a little bit in our pre-GPHG episode. But no smartwatches actually made it to the final six.
No smartwatches made it to the final cut. There were smartwatches in the first round of voting, and I guess we should probably, you know, talk a little bit about sort of that aspect as well. You know, there's the first round of competing watches, and watches are submitted by brands in the for the first round of voting. So the GPHG doesn't really have any control over that other than, I mean, I suppose there's some circumstance under which they would say, well, I'm sorry, but that watch isn't appropriate for the submitted category.
Right.
You know, but generally speaking, it's kind of, you know, come one, come all. You think you've got something that fits in a particular category, bring it on. So that's a very large group of watches. So in the ladies category, for instance, in the first round of voting, there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
There were like 20 something, right?
7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, I think.
That's
which
a
is
lot.
A lot of watches. So the first round of voting happens online.
Okay.
Meet to go over those. So from those watches, the first round of voting selects six, and those six watches are the ones we actually touch and feel when we get to Geneva for the last round of jury.
Okay. I got to say, a little disappointing that even though the Tag Heuer connected watch was submitted for this category, that it didn't make it through.
Yeah, I think it would have been interesting to have a smartwatch there. I mean, but talk about provoking debate, you know?
Yeah, but that's the whole point of the category, right?
Yeah,
like it seems to kind of defeat the purpose. But
absolutely. Absolutely.
The ultimate winner here was the Nomos Tangenta Neomatic 41 update, which beat some pretty wonderful watches in that category.
It did.
That was
it
a
did.
Pretty competitive category.
Yeah, the challenge category, it's an interesting one to have. And I think that, there's been a little bit of a tendency in the past, for GPHG to really focus on the high end. And of course, obviously the high end is great. We all love the high end. There's a lot of beautiful stuff. But the sort of watches that, Ben likes to say watches that actually matter in most people's lives, are probably not the $350,000 ultra mega complications, but rather, watches in, this particular category, which often represent, for their buyers, an expression of a lot of love for watchmaking. And, let's get real. I mean, for most people, 4,000 Swiss or the US equivalent, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a lot of money to spend on a mechanical
watch. Real watch, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
I think the big upset here was the Tudor Black Bay GMT was also in this category.
Yep.
And I think was kind of the clear favorite going in. No knock against the Nomos or any of the other competitors.
Yeah.
But
yeah. Yeah. You know, the Tudor is obviously a fabulous watch, and you know, I mean, demand for it is very high. It's a there's really nothing that you can say against any of these watches in and of themselves.
Sure.
You know, like let's see. You know, Octavio Garcia's brand Gorilla.
Yeah.
The Gorilla Fastback Drift. You know, this is a pretty nifty little watch. Now, you might be, well, not little, actually. It's quite a nifty, you know, rather.
I was going to say.
You know, but it's something, now, again, the design is going to be dichotomizing for sure. But if you sort of say to yourself, okay, you know, this watch is not trying to be a 36 millimeter mid-century anti-magnetic paddock. You know, I mean, that's just not what's going on.
It's in fact probably the least like that watch of any watch I can imagine.
It's right up there. But you know, it's under 4,000 Swiss, wandering hours complication, which is, you know, a pretty fantastic thing to see at this price point. And, you know, with Octavio, you're always going to get really, you know, sort of bold, forward-looking design. There's some great case materials. The overall build quality is really terrific. You know, but again, we have this watch competing against, say, the Tudor or the Nomos. And, you know, again, these are watches that don't have a whole lot to do with each other stylistically.
Right.
So I think it's when you look at any of these watches, you sort of... There are things to love about each one. You know, so the Tudor, for example, you know, this is a watch we love partly because of what it is from Tudor, partly because it sort of harkens back to, you know, the those wonderful anodized aluminum dial GMT Masters, which Rolex, you know, now makes with, you know, ceramic bezels. And that's a whole separate conversation that, you know, we don't need to have now. But, you know, there's a lot about it to love. You know, great functionality, just a wonderful, practical travel watch, tough as nails. You know, you can wear it all day and never be unhappy with it. The Seiko Presage Chipot enamel, you know, a gorgeous, you know, Flanke enamel dial, you know, genuine fired enamel dial, at an amazing price point. And quite a few of the jurors who looked at it, you know, didn't realize, you know, that they sort of looked at it and they said to themselves, well, wait a minute, this is a fired enamel dial watch in an under 4,000 price category, you know, which you certainly don't see coming out of Switzerland terribly often. And, you know, a lot of the folks, especially the industry folks who were on the jury, were quite, you know, positively impressed by that. I think at the end of the day, the Nomos was selected because it had... And this is the case for a lot of categories. It had a combination of features that appealed to the widest range of jury members.
Okay.
You know? So, you know, a great, you know, Bauhaus-influenced design, a very interesting take on a date complication. And, you know, to do a date complication within the sort of Bauhaus design language and not use, you know, some variation of a date window, well, that's a pretty tricky thing to
do. Yeah, absolutely.
You know. I think that it just had, it really came down to, you know, mass appeal in this case.
All right. So the first win goes to Nomos.
Yep.
And now a word from this week's sponsor. Hook & Albert is a modern travel brand. And last week I sat down with CEO Adam Schoenberg to talk about how they got started. He's back this week and we're going to talk a little bit about the design of the products. Thanks for joining us, Adam.
Thanks for having me, Stephen.
So is there an overarching design philosophy that guides everything you do at Hook & Albert?
Sure. I think the first thing we always focus on is the actual journey and the customer we're building around. And that's someone who travels for 1 to 3 days. We classify them as a sprint traveler. And that person really needs product that fits their lifestyle. We don't really focus on technical fabrics, but more of luxurious ones. So we like to play with leathers and suedes, and we really want to build something that's not only functional, but truly beautiful.
When you're designing these bags, how do you think about the balance between the function and the utility on one hand, and then the design and the kind of natural beauty of the materials on the other hand?
I think everyone can build something that's beautiful. The most important thing for us is you have to have the function down, and our whole entire objective is to simplify one's journey. So once we figure out what we're creating and what that function is and how it makes that journey simple, we then turn around and say, okay, now that we have the structure, how can we wrap that around the most beautiful leathers and the best zippers and really build something that people are proud to have with them when they're traveling?
And how do you think a beautifully designed bag can change the way somebody experiences travel?
I think it's an extension of who they are. It's a product that is very personal. It's by their side. So I feel that by someone embracing this product, being something that fits their lifestyle, it really makes the connection a lot more unique and special.
Yeah, the way you're describing this, it actually reminds me in a funny way of a watch. You know, it's an object that has to be functional, but a lot of the pleasure comes from the beauty and from living with it and really making it a part of your life, right?
100%. I mean, for me, I've always loved watches, and I always travel and wear a GMT watch because it fits that travel lifestyle. And bags are very much the same thing. That bag has to fit into the actual journey that we're doing.
Awesome. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll be back next week to learn a little more.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's get back to the show. All right, so up next is the petite aiguille, which is another kind of budget-driven category. This is for watches between 4,000, so at the upper end of the challenge, up to 10,000 Swiss francs. And winning that category was the Hebring Doppelfelix chronograph, which Hebring is no stranger to winning this category. It seems like they win now almost every year.
I think Hebring is also no stranger to, you know, this is not as sort of bang for the buck driven as the challenge category. But, you know, there's, I think in the petite aiguille category, you're still sort of saying to yourself, okay, so what am I getting for my 4 to 10 Swiss? And it's a room full of people who, all other things being equal, you know, consider themselves serious watch people. And I think that the Hebring is a really sort of a serious watch person's watch. There are, you know, there are always things that you can like or dislike about any particular watch. I mean, you know, you can sort of say to yourself, oh, hey, this ought to be a 38 millimeter, you know, chronograph instead of what it is. But for what it is, I think a lot of jurors felt that it was just a fantastic value. A wonderful evolution of the Ratrapont, you know, the split seconds chronograph complication.
It's a split seconds with a date.
Yeah, it's split seconds with a date, with a very, very nicely done date, by the way, which I think really helped its chances with the jury. And, you know, it's a wonderful piece of watchmaking history, too, as a lot of serious, you know, watch folks know. Richard Hebring's the guy who designed the original, you know, sort of affordable, quote-unquote, Ratrapont chronograph for IWC back in the 90s. And, you know, he's continued to evolve and tweak his design. And it's just it's a watch that wins hearts and minds on a lot of different levels. From a technical standpoint, it's a super cool piece. From a bang for the buck standpoint, it's a super cool piece. From a sort of like, you know, I think that the jury has a little bit of a soft spot for, you know, the plucky underdog independent watchmaker narrative.
And for sure.
And, you know, I mean, the Hebrings, you know, have really, you know, persisted in evolving and tweaking their designs. And I think this is one of the best things they've ever done.
Yeah,
it seems to have been the consensus.
It was fun to see also, so the brand is run by a husband and wife team, Richard and Maria Hebring. So seeing them get up on stage together and, you know, despite the fact that they won before, they were clearly really emotional about this.
Yeah,
and
seeing
the two of them stand there and accept this award was really something special.
Yeah.
Kind of warms your heart a little bit.
It warmed my heart a lot.
Yeah.
To the extent that my heart is warmable.
You have a warm heart, Jack. You play tough, but... up next, we have the sports category, another sufficiently vague category of watches,
but with
a good field.
Yep.
And this one was taken by Seiko for the Prospex 1968 Divers re-edition, which stirred up a little bit of controversy, I would say.
Okay, so where did you see the controversy?
So I have to say, I thought Seiko was the favorite here, and I said that last week, you know, competing against the Fabergé that you mentioned that uses the Agenor chronograph movement, a really beautiful watch from Montblanc, but a pocket watch, a Zenith Pilots chronograph, which is great, but something pretty similar to what they've been doing for a while. A Ulysse Nardin diver that, again, great, but not something that strikes me as super different from what they've been doing. And TAG's kind of Gulf liveried Monaco, which, again, is something pretty traditional.
Now, I by the way, on the Monaco Gulf, I have to say that's one of those watches that, you know, and this sort of speaks to how, you know, like jury decision making, you know, can go on and just taste in general. I look at that thing and I see the Gulf logo and I'm like 6 years old on a business trip with my dad again.
Yeah. So I thought Seiko was the favorite here, but if we think about, you know, this in the context of the ceremony itself, you come right out of the gate and the first three prizes go to a German watchmaker, an Austrian watchmaker, and a Japanese watchmaker
right.
in Geneva
yeah.
for the Grand Prix de Genève. You know,
right,
people,
exactly.
there was kind of, you could feel out in the crowd, you could feel it getting kind of tense that we're three awards in and the Swiss yeah. haven't won anything
right,
yet.
Right, right, right. Well, you know, it's... there are two ways in which Geneva is the world capital of watchmaking. The first is, of course, it was kind of the center of manufacturing and assembly processes
right.
for, you know, what, I mean, you know, John Calvin came to Geneva in, I forget exactly when, you know, but like mid-1500s, I think.
Sure.
And, you know.
I'm going to let you run with that one.
Yeah. And, you know, suddenly, you know, all of these sumptuary laws were passed and suddenly the jewelers couldn't make jewelry anymore. But it became a center of assembly for watches and fine watchmaking in very short order. And, you know, that tradition is, you know, with us down to the present day. And that's part
right.
of the, you know, part of the joy of Swiss watchmaking. It's just such a cool piece of, you know, really European and even world history. The other way in which it's a center of watchmaking is it's kind of a communication center. So, I mean, these are all, even though watches might come from, you know, someplace that's not Switzerland per se, there's still an awful lot of appreciation for just good watchmaking here.
For
so
sure.
I'll take the Seiko as an example. You know, you and I both over the years have, you know, we've made a lot of friends in Switzerland and a lot of friends in the industry. And you know, I mean, and you've probably, I think you've had this experience too. You hear a lot of admiration expressed, often off the record, but you hear an awful lot of admiration expressed for Seiko and Grand Seiko by people in the Swiss watchmaking industry.
Absolutely.
And
especially the people who really get it.
Yeah, yeah.
You can kind of tell who really knows what they're talking about
right.
and who doesn't.
Right.
By the people who poo-poo Seiko or
right.
get excited about Seiko.
Right.
You know, the people who, you know, see somebody wearing a Grand Seiko and kind of turn their nose up, you know immediately that they don't actually know what they're talking about.
Yeah, or just that, I mean, I'll, without mentioning names, I'll give you two examples. So there's one person that I know who has been involved with watches there. See, I'm using a gender-neutral pronoun, just to, like, no clues. And this person has been involved with watches their entire professional life, grew up around them, and has, you know, has seen, you know, just about everything that the watch industry has to offer. And this person has a little bit of a hard time getting around the fact that if a watch is called Seiko to them, that's an also-ran, just because
okay.
it's, and not because it's, you know, comes from Japan necessarily, but just because, like, that name is not associated with an aspirational, you know, category.
Okay.
On the other hand, you know, there's another person that I know who has been, who's an extremely influential person in the watch industry from a design perspective. And I was very, very surprised to hear this from this person. You know, they actually adore Grand Seiko from a design standpoint. And this is a person who's not necessarily driven by, you know, the values that make a lot of, you know, serious watch nuts gravitate towards Grand Seiko, but this person just thinks it's they're amazing designs,
which they are.
Yeah,
to be fair.
Yeah. So you know, this is all by way of saying, I think that it's an interesting thing, right? Three first prize winners in three different categories, one right after the other, and not a Swiss watch among them, but good watchmaking. You know, and one
Completely.
Of the things that I'm kind of like, you know, proud of as a juror is, you know, we're interested in. And the GPHG, I think, is open to good watches regardless of where they come from. A good watch is a good watch first. And, it, you know, certainly, as we can see, it doesn't have to be Swiss to win.
For sure. All right, let's go to two categories that we talked about a little bit already.
Mm-hmm.
Next up was the men's category,
yep.
Which was won by Acrivia for the mm-hmm. Chronomet Contemporain,
yep.
Which, as you alluded to earlier, is probably my personal favorite watch of
yeah,
the year.
Yeah.
I went to the booth. I talked about this last week, but I went to the booth at Baselworld and didn't really know what to expect. And mm-hmm. as I walked in, Philippe Dufour walked out and I said,
yeah.
okay, this might be something.
right, right.
And this watch is just unbelievable. I mean, from a technical
yeah.
standpoint, from the movement architecture to the finishing, to the design of the dial and the shape of the case. Like
yeah.
to me,
yeah.
this is simplicity level stuff. Like this is one of the best time only watches being produced anywhere today.
For sure. And you know, I think under the best of circumstances, a winning watch in any of these categories kind of transcends the category.
That's a good thing to think about.
Yeah, and I think the Acrivia is it's just such a wonderful watch on so many levels. It's kind of irresistible. You know, I mean, you look at the quality of the movement finishing, and you know, this is a young guy who has, you know, I mean, all he's done, you know, for the last few years is work with unceasing fervor at, you know, trying to make what is, in his view, the best, you know, possible watch and the most interesting possible watch.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, the finishing is incredible. I think he's done a fantastic job with the design. You know, and as we were talking about before, this is a difficult category to evaluate. You get down to these final six watches and gosh, you know, there's not a whole lot of similarity between any of them.
It's kind of at this point, it's a gut feeling.
Yeah,
right?
For sure. For sure.
I think one of the things that I loved about this last night was this award got announced and the crowd went nuts. Like people were cheering and whooping and hollering. Like people went crazy for this guy who makes like, I think he makes like, you know, 50, 60 watches a year.
Yeah. And you know,
in Geneva, it's like him and his brother and a couple other watchmakers.
Yeah.
It's certainly not something where, you know, he's like an industry legend.
Right.
But people were so excited for him. And he has a really fascinating story. You know, he, his family were refugees, came to Geneva when he was young, I believe from the Balkans. He kind of had to face some adversity, and he's been doing this for 15 years, mostly kind of unrecognized, and to finally get this jumping off point, I think everybody who knows him and knows what this represents, really were kind of happy for him genuinely. And you could see in his acceptance speech that he was just completely overwhelmed.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think the reaction from the audience speaks to the degree to which Geneva is both, a really cosmopolitan international town, but also kind of a village. I mean, you know, it's amazing after coming here, you know, to write about watches for, you know, probably close to 15 years now, it's a small town.
Oh, completely.
Everybody knows everybody.
Absolutely.
You know, and I mean, you can miss that whole, you know, side of Geneva if you just come here for business. You know, I mean, you know, you're on an expense account and, you know, you stay in the hotel. And
one of the four hotels.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. You know, you stay in the same hotels and, you know, you have meetings in the same meeting rooms and, you can do that for your entire professional life and never really sort of get to know Geneva outside of that part of Geneva that's kind of, you know, walled off, you know, for business travelers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can get a lot of work done. But if you cover watches, I think you see probably a side of the actual day-to-day life of Geneva that is maybe a little bit harder. I wouldn't know because, I'm obviously not in the pharma industry or banking or anything like that. And God knows I've never, you know, worked for the UN. But it's a very, very, very close-knit community, and it's a family, really.
It's
like a giant extended family. And
that's
like
true.
And like every family, you know, there are people who, like, refuse to speak to each other, and, you know, like, their kids aren't allowed to talk to to the other guy's kids at Christmas. but it really is a family, and I think a lot of people were rooting for him just because there's a lot of respect for, you know, what he's tried to do over the last years, And there's a sense that he is kind of, you know, a relatively young person who's an embodiment of a lot of values that the industry really, really respects, and that it's maybe a little bit harder for the bigger brands to actualize because of the, you know, pressures that they're under as, you know, larger business entities and as in many cases group brands. And he doesn't have to operate under those constraints,
right?
Which gives him a lot of freedom, but also means, you know, much, much higher risks. And to see his persistence and vision awarded, I think everybody was just like, you know, yeah.
I agree.
Go you, you know.
So moving to the ladies category, this one went to Chanel for the Boyfriend Skelet, which I think was a favorite of many people at Hodinkee over the course of the year.
Yeah.
This watch is awesome. These are the movements that are designed in partnership with Roman Gauthier.
Yep.
So kind of a little hat tip to Roman for your work winning here.
Yeah.
But this watch is just awesome. You know, it's a really cool skeletonized movement, like very, very open skeletonized movement set into a rectangular case with some diamonds.
Yeah.
You have Chanel's proprietary beige gold for the case. It's really a cool watch.
It's a super cool watch. And like many of the winning watches in other categories, it's a watch that brings together you know, there are watches that are dichotomizing and there are kind of watches that everybody can, you know, can sort of get behind.
Yeah.
And this is a watch I think a lot of people felt like they could get behind. It's classic Chanel design. You know, it's extremely chic. They got points from the movement nerds for, producing basically a one-off movement, you know, for this particular watch. Yeah, it's a bit expensive, but, you don't have advantages of scale to work with. And, you want something that's kind of unique, not only from a design standpoint, but mechanically. And there's a little bit of a premium associated with that. And, I would actually... This is a watch that I personally would love. I wouldn't want the diamonds on the bezel necessarily for an everyday watch. As a gents watch, I think it could work just fine.
I think you should wear this watch with the diamonds. Yeah. I would love that. If anybody wants to crowdfund getting Jack a diamond set Chanel boyfriend skillet.
I'm open.
Should we start a GoFundMe and put it in the show notes?
GoFund my men's diamond watch.
I would be really into that. So... Going on to more diamonds, mm-hmm. Next up was the jewelry category, which was extra special because that's the category you presented, right?
Yeah. I'm going to be honest. I can't think of anybody on the jury probably more ill-equipped to present a...
Oh, I disagree.
Well, you know, it's, I mean, I've tried to learn as much as I can about, gem quality in general and horological gem setting, but this is one of those things where, you know, if you don't have someone telling you what to look for, and if you don't look at a lot of stones and get a chance, you know, and get a chance to kind of compare the good, the amazing with the merely fantastic, you know, to the, just pretty good, you know, and sort of, you know, on down the scale. It's a very, very, very difficult field to evaluate for somebody who spends most of their, like I do, spends most of their time looking at watches on their sort of technical and practical merits. You know, that said, I thought there was some, you know, I mean, each one of these watches, kind of had its own things to recommend it. A lot of beautiful stones, some really, really fantastic, setting work. The Prezioso, for example, the trillion tourbillon of tourbillons. I mean, it is what it is, as they say. But the quality of the stones is fantastic. And, just a sort of a big over the top, statement piece, I mean, it's
the equivalent of, was the Van Cleef.
Yeah. The winner was the Van Cleef. So the Secret de Coccinelle is a secret watch, and one of the things I think that
I love
was,
the term secret watch,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
There's something so I don't know, sort of charming about the idea of it's a secret watch.
It's a secret watch.
Don't tell anyone.
What's the secret?
There's a watch.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's there's something sexy about secrets, right?
Sure.
And it's a pretty damn sexy watch. I mean, the design is fantastic. The sort of leaf with a ladybug sitting on it. I personally love jewelry watches that have, I hate to use the word because it's like such a,
coming.
Well, you hear somebody say whimsy and you think, well, there's a jerk.
Oh, boy.
But there's a wonderful a wonderful air of whimsy.
You get to use that word once a year on the pod.
Yeah. Yeah, and one of the great things about the Van Cleef is it's a high jewelry ladies watch, but with a mechanical movement as well.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Which I think was a very big draw for the jury. All other things being equal, a room full of serious watch people. I think the sentiment, fair or not, is that a high jewelry watch with a quartz movement is basically a piece of jewelry with, the sort of time telling as an afterthought, and to sort of go the extra mile and put in a very, very small mechanical movement was, I think that's something that won a lot of jury members over.
Sure. Sticking with the kind of arts and crafts theme, let's go to the métier d'art category.
Yeah.
Which was won by Hermès for mm-hmm. the Arceau Robe du Soir, mm-hmm. which is a really fascinating watch. It has a dial that is a mosaic image of a horse.
Yep.
But the mosaic is not tile or stones. It's tiny pieces of leather.
Yes.
Thousands of tiny pieces of leather.
Yes. Yes.
It's super weird.
Many, many tiny pieces of leather.
I'm into it.
And so is the jury, apparently. If you're at there were some, for various reasons, all of the other pieces in this category, they were there for a reason, obviously. You look at the Vacheron, for instance, and, enameling and engraving and, yada, 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 sort of like, a lot of different, fairly challenging high craft things going on in that particular piece. But I think the Hermes is, doing a leather mosaic of a horse.
It's so Hermes.
That might be the most Hermes thing.
It's awesome.
That Hermes could possibly have done.
You can tell I have a big, kind of like shit eating grin on my face here, but it's super cool.
Yeah, exactly. And, so say you, so said the jury. And, I think people just sort of fell in love with both the idea and the execution. And it's different, different is never bad. Well, no, it can be terrible. I take that.
I wasn't going to challenge you on that, but, next up was the ladies' complication category.
Yeah.
And that went again to Van Cleef. That's a twofer for Van Cleef.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is for the Lady Arpels Planetarium, which if you are a regular reader of Hodinkee, you will know we are all huge fans of this complication with the kind of mini planetarium under this really dramatic domed crystal. It's just flat out awesome. Like this to me was one of the shoe-ins of the show. Like if this watch didn't win, I would have been shocked.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Arguments for the other pieces as well. They're good arguments for all of these watches, pro and con. But a little solar system on your wrist. It's another example of how the winning watch typically represents kind of like the whole package. So we've got an amazing, pretty rare complication. We've got an execution that is really driven by the mechanics of the complication, but also kind of transcends it from a design standpoint. And then it's just so not whimsical.
you're not allowed to say that.
But it's
again
a very kind of like poetically compelling complication. And I think Van Cleef did something really beautiful with this. You just sort of look at it and it transports you. It takes you a little bit out of yourself,
totally.
Right?
So that's two wins for Van Cleef, mm-hmm. one win for Hermes, and one win for Chanel. Mm-hmm. And I think it's cool to see, obviously all of these brands have been making watches for quite a long time.
Yep.
But I think there are brands that sometimes, quote unquote, serious watch people, whatever that means, don't necessarily take as seriously as they should.
Yeah.
And I think this is a good lesson that there are some folks outside of the traditional pantheon of who we think of as high watchmakers. Doing really good things and things that, in a lot of these cases, there are great movements associated with these watches and great technical innovations associated with these watches. But mm-hmm. either way, they're making really great products that excite people.
Yeah,
and that's,
for sure.
Not something that I think can be brushed aside easily.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So after the ladies' complication category, we had the men's complication category. And that went to Laurent Ferrier for the Galet annual calendar. What are your thoughts on this one?
All of these categories are challenging to evaluate simply because, most of the watches that make it into the final round of voting, they get in for a reason. Out of 20 some watches, this you pare it down to six and you're going to get some, pretty fantastic stuff.
Sure.
I found this one really, really hard because I think that there are maybe more than any other category, there are things to sort of individually really, really like about each one of these. And again, not to everybody's taste. But you look at the Girard Perregaux Neo Tourbillon, for instance, and it's next to the shown next to the Moser on the GPHG website, and boy oh boy do those watches have nothing to do with each other
completely
in terms of design aspirations, in terms of style, in terms of what they say about each of the companies that make them, in terms of what the designers were going for. They just have zip to do with each other.
Sure.
The Bulgari Octo Finissova Tourbillon automatic, you look at that next to the Crayon Everywhere, the Vacheron, which is probably the closest to the Laurent Ferrier in terms of what it's going for, but still going for something pretty
different.
And that's
different. The ultra-thin overseas QP,
that's
right.
Right. That's right. As a juror, you have to make a decision. You just sort of can't, go back to the...
you can't just throw your hands up in the air and say,
I love you all. I really thought that these were, six just fantastic watches. And, without getting to the specifics of which one, I personally found the most appealing, I really struggled with this one.
I
think a lot of the jury did too.
I love the Laurent Ferrier, but I'm shocked the Bulgari didn't win this category.
Yeah.
That's the Octo Finissimo Tourbillon Ultra Thin.
Yep.
Like, I'm I'm shocked that watch didn't win.
Yeah.
That watch set 3 world records. Yep. That is a serious, serious watch.
Yeah.
And again, no knock against Laurent Ferrier. And it was great to see Mr. Ferrier himself go up to accept the award.
Yep.
But I this one shocked me.
Not that Bulgari needs a whole lot of help at this point in terms of getting people
sure.
to, you know, I mean, just as an aside, I think one of the amazing things about Bulgari is the degree to which they have really taken their sort of, you know, core assets and competencies and made themselves into a watch brand that that you just like have to take seriously.
Totally.
You know, like them or dislike them, they have they've done some really, really incredible things in quite a short period of time. And I think it speaks to you know, how well they've done in general with both the technical and the aesthetic aspects of their watchmaking, that it seems like they've been doing it forever.
Yeah.
And they haven't.
Right.
You know,
right.
You know, at this level.
Next up, there is the chronograph category, which was taken by Singer Reimagined.
Mm-hmm.
We talked a little bit about this watch before, but the technical aspects of this watch are sort of unimpeachable, I guess.
You know, the Singer is, I think the Singer is a really cool piece. The, you know, it's, to make a very feeble pun, it's a very movement-driven watch.
Oh, boy.
It's so the Agengraph chronograph movement is, if you want to do a deep dive on you know, some of the most interesting and possibly controversial aspects of modern movement design, this is a great place to start and
you
finish.
Have done that, I believe, on
the site. Yeah. It's you know, and you know, me personally, there are things that I find absolutely fantastic about it, but you also sort of say to yourself, well, gosh, you know, how many of these, you know, sort of exotic technical solutions that introduce a great deal of complexity and bring in a lot of modern material science, you know, how much do we really need? You know, in terms of, you know, just sort of a classic well-built lateral clutch chronograph.
Totally.
I mean, you know, one of the criticisms that you could make of the Agengraph is, well, you know, these are solutions kind of in search of real problems. Mm-hmm. And like, what's wrong with a nice lateral clutch chronograph? But on the other hand, you know, if the question is, do we really need this? Well, you could say that about, you know, the whole enterprise of mechanical watchmaking as a whole. So in terms of, I think it won a lot of hearts and minds on the strength of its ingenuity. I think it's sort of, you know, retro, cool, looking forward and backward, you know, design appealed to a lot of people. And I mean, gosh, you know, Jean-Marc Wiederecht is, you know, he's one of our great treasures.
He was holding court last night.
He was. And I think that there was just a sense on the part of the jury that so again, you know, there were a lot of narratives that brought people together. There was the sort of independent mad genius narrative. There was the sort of hardcore movement nerd narrative. You know, there was the sort of retro cool, you know, sort of design element. So I think that this was a watch that a lot of people could like for a lot of different reasons.
Nice. Going in a different direction, there was the chronometry award.
Mm-hmm.
So these are watches that are kind of focused on precision and accuracy,
right,
you know,
right.
Tourbillons, Remontoirs, and the like. And here we have a Debatun, the DB25 Starry Various, which if you've never seen a Debatun in the metal, figure out who near you retails them and go see one.
Yeah.
Or find a collector who has one and go see one. These watches are unbelievable in the metal.
Yeah.
Even if they're not sort of personally your style, like I can't see myself ever wearing a Debatun on a regular basis,
but
they are unbelievable pieces of art and watchmaking. And this watch is no exception. I mean, this is a constant force tourbillon with a deadbeat seconds. Like this is real serious stuff. And then on top of it all, high polished titanium, you know, blue dial.
Yeah.
Like it's really, you know, top to bottom, a killer piece.
Yeah, I mean, to see you well. I mean, you've said it. There's not a whole heck of a lot left for me to say. There's that's really, you know, again, it was sort of the whole package, and you know, for a watch to win in any of these categories, I think it really has to cut across, you know, sort of several divides in terms of taste. And there's a lot to like. Not that other watches in this category didn't, you know, do that either, but there's something so immediately visually compelling about the Debatun. You know, that giant expanse of blue with you know, with a you know, sort of star motif, and then everything that's going on technically, you know, and the sort of you know, like comeback kid, you know, narrative behind it. I mean, it's I think it won for a reason.
Awesome. We're starting to get toward the end. So the last of the kind of standard prizes of the standard categories is the mechanical exception category. Mm-hmm. And for that, we have the Grubel Forzi Grand Sonnery.
Yeah.
I got to admit, I have no idea what the hell mechanical exception means.
Yeah, I'm not sure that that we on the jury have any idea what it means.
I don't think anybody does. I've never talked to anyone who knows what that category is. Yeah. But I feel like regardless of how you define it, this watch fits the bill. Like, it doesn't really matter how you define it.
Right, right.
This watch has been in process for a number of years. You know, there were some ups and downs, I know, in its development, mm-hmm. but it's finally ready. It's out there, and it's basically superlative as it gets.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. You know, it's everything that if you love Grubel Forzi, it's everything that you love about Grubel Forzi.
Right.
You know, a sort of
I love the if there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, their watches are certainly not everybody's brand of vodka from a design standpoint.
Brand of vodka. I like that. That's a good choice, Jack.
It is maximalist watchmaking, for sure. But it's not maximalist watchmaking just for the sake of being, you know, kind of an over-the-top visual statement. You know, you go in there and you start. And one of the things that Grubel Forzi is justly famous for is the quality of its finishing. And this is really luxury in one of the most old-school senses possible. You know, I mean, their whole approach to watchmaking is it takes as long as it takes, and it costs as much as it costs. And take it or leave it. And
sure.
Most of us have to leave it because, you know, it's a $650,000 watch or, you know, whatever the price is. But, you know, in the abstract, you look at this and the design is dichotomizing, but from a sort of mechanical ingenuity standpoint and from a finishing standpoint as well, you know, you might not care for the, you know, the design language in the abstract, but I think that if you're a serious watch person, you know, and you start looking at the quality of execution on every element, it's like, it's hair-raising.
Yeah.
You know, how good it is.
The first time, this is another one kind of similarly to Debatun. Like,
yeah.
If you've never seen a Grubel in person,
right,
go find one.
Right.
Like, track one down and see it.
Right.
Again,
and we forget, like, we get a Grubel in the office to photograph, you know, once or twice a year, and I actually had a chance to wear one as a sort of, like, you know, walk-around piece at Baselworld a couple
true.
Of years
I forgot
ago,
about
which
that.
Which was, like, that was kind of, like, that was really peak loan watch.
Jack walking around Basel with a Grubel Forzi GMT on his wrist in platinum was something to see.
It was a little terrifying. I avoided the more dangerous neighborhoods of Basel. But the point that I'm trying to make, I guess, is that it's really, really hard to see a Grubel Forzi in person. I mean, they make under 100 watches a year.
Right.
And, you know, unless you're a watch journalist or you have pretty highfalutin friends, it's fairly hard to see one of the, you know, I mean, I can't remember the last time I saw one even at a watch event. Like, they just don't make that many of them.
True.
But boy, oh boy, is it worth seeing one in person.
Yeah.
You know?
So now we're into the special prizes. So we'll move through these a little faster. These are essentially special prizes that the jury awards, right, Jack, that mm-hmm. you kind of pick from the overall selection of watches.
That's right. That's right. And by the way, for the special jury prizes, you're not restricted to the 6 finalist watches. You can pick from any.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I didn't know that. Fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, spoiler alert, all of the winners are from the shortlist, but.
But there have been years in which
that
wasn't the case.
I never knew that.
Yeah.
Every day's a school day, people.
Yep.
So first up, the Audacity Prize. It's exactly what it sounds like. Mm-hmm. And this went to Konstantin Chaikin for the Clown Watch.
Yep.
Which I'll admit, no offense to Konstantin. What he's doing is mechanically interesting and seems to excite a lot of people. I'm so not into this. It's just not my thing at all. And it seems like we've been talking about this watch or some variation on this watch for like 3 or 4 years now. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of over it, dude.
Oh, yeah?
How
come?
I just can't. I'm just over it. It just feels like I get it. It's provocative. It's interesting. There's some cool stuff going on mechanically. I'm glad he did this. Great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I feel like this is a thing like we should have acknowledged it once. And then been like, okay, cool. We're moving on now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it seems like every year now there's like a new variant. It wins some prize or like it ends up on everybody's like best of Baselworld lists.
Right,
and I'm just over it. I'm just over it. And again, no offense to him. And I'm not trying to like poo-poo what he's doing. Like,
sure.
I'm all about supporting independent watchmaking, mm-hmm. but like this just...
Are you though, Stephen?
Maybe not, apparently. Stephen Pulver, an enemy of independent watchmakers. Yeah, I don't know. I'm just over it.
I mean, hey, look, it's a very, very love it or hate it watch, maybe more so than any other piece in the entire lineup. If you're looking for audacity, it's pretty audacious.
That's fair. That's fair.
And my personal feeling is that recognition from the GPHG specifically was a little bit overdue for this particular piece. And you know, it's the audacity category, first year for the audacity category. And we haven't really had there was a design category, in the early days for the GPHG, which sort of went away after a certain point. And I'm not 100% sure why, because I wasn't part of the, you know, proceedings back in those days. But you know, if you think about it, there really isn't another category where you can put together watches whose primary goal is to get your eyelids right up underneath your eyebrows. This is a place now where, you know, finally we have a chance to put watches that are really trying to do something different that is well, audacious. I mean, you know,
right.
for lack of a better word.
All right.
And I think
I'll give you that.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll concede that one.
Yeah. And, I think the Chaikin was, I think it charmed a lot of people. And, there was a strong sense that, from the jury that they wanted in general, that we wanted to, kind of express our appreciation for the guts to go do something different. And, the differentness of, Mr. Chaikin's approach.
Okay.
I wish I knew what he'd said in Russian. I suppose I could try and find
the translation. Yeah, it was the only speech last night given in Russian. So the ceremony, for people who don't know, the ceremony is conducted predominantly, almost exclusively in French, with occasional presenters and award winners speaking in their native languages. So there's some English. We got some German. A little Japanese. Yeah. And then we got some Russian toward the end of the ceremony.
Yep.
Next, we have the Innovation Prize.
Yeah.
And this went to a watch that I would imagine, Jack, was probably one of your favorite watches of the whole awards.
Well, yeah.
Which is the Crayon Everywhere Horizon watch, which is the first watch, I believe, to feature an independently settable sunrise and sunset indicator.
That's correct.
So it's not hard-coded into the movement. Normally, if you get a sunrise sunset, the watch is made for a particular location on Earth.
Exactly. It's made for a particular latitude and longitude. And it works. Sunrise sunset watches, they basically work the way an equation of time works. There's a little potato shaped, kind of a lumpy potato, but there's a little potato shaped cam that rotates once per year. And there's a feeler that rides around on the outside of the cam. And that feeler controls the position of a hand. And the cams are specific to a particular latitude and longitude. So, you can get a watch that shows you the sunrise, sunset in Geneva, but it's not going to work in New York or Sao Paulo or wherever else you happen to be. And the cool thing about the Crayon, and it's just such an ingenious watch, it's a little analog astronomical computer. So you input certain data, you input GMT, date, your latitude and longitude, and it will actually output through a very, very ingeniously designed, it's an engineering achievement as much as it is a watchmaking achievement. It will output the correct time for sunrise and sunset for your particular location pretty much anywhere on Earth. I think you have to be south of the Arctic Circle and north of the Antarctic Circle or something like that.
Okay.
It doesn't work in what's the northernmost decent-sized town in Norway? I think it's like Tromslo or something like that.
Shout out to Tromslo, Norway.
Right. In terms of innovation, really never been done before. First of all, there aren't that many sunrise sunset watches to begin with. Oh. The first two I would have to look up the dates, but back in the early 2000s, we had the Audemars Piguet.
That watch is so awesome.
The equation of time, the Jules Audemars equation of time.
I was thinking of the Royal Oak.
Yeah.
There's a Royal Oak that does Royal Oak sunrise, Oak. Sunset. That's amazing.
So
the equation of time.
Same movement, but it was originally introduced in a Jules Audemars case. Martin Braun, just a couple of months after that, after the AP came out with his EOS watch, EOS, which sunrise sunset watch as well. And I keep meaning to try and find one because when that came out, it just knocked everybody's socks off. Also, and the whole sort of scrappy independent independent watchmaker narrative was working for him as well. But you know, you see them done very, very occasionally as one-offs for particular locations. But the reason that you don't see them made very often is because every one of them is basically a custom piece. Like the client comes to you and says, "Okay, I live in New York, and I'd like a Joule on Mar Equation of Time." And they say, "Okay, thank you." And AP, they don't make that particular watch anymore, but it's the same for the Royal Oak version. AP basically says, "Okay, thank you for the deposit. We'll get back to you in, I forget how long it takes, like 13 to 18 months, I think." And they calculate the correct shape of the cam, and the cams are cut and polished and placed in the watch, and the whole thing has to be assembled. And then you get your watch, and it'll show you sunrise and sunset in that one particular spot on Earth.
And then you have to move.
And then if you move...
And you throw yourself off a bridge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or, and then after you, crawl back to the bank and crawl back up on the bridge and say to yourself, well, that was kind of an emotional reaction to a problem with the watch. Then, you call up AP or, whichever one of, just a tiny handful of other companies make these things. And they will cut new cams for you.
Right.
But that's a whole process as well. So, sure. To be able to have a sunrise sunset watch that works absolutely anywhere, and that you can, once you know how the programming process works, you can literally do all of the inputs in under 5 minutes.
That's wild.
In a watch that for all of its complexity is very, very legible and really, really easy to use and a very wearable size. It deserved this prize so richly, I think.
Awesome. Then we have the Revival Prize, which is for something vintage inspired.
Right.
And this one went to Vacheron Constantin for the Historique Calendrier 1942 triple calendar.
Right. Now, I'm assuming that you didn't find this a controversial choice.
Not at all. Yeah. Absolutely not. I think this was the right choice, if I can say that.
Yeah.
I think that watch is amazing and it kind of fits the bill perfectly.
And talk about a watch that you could live with every day.
No question.
These beautiful, beautiful, exquisite thin hands, extremely tastefully done dial, classic, sort of date hand complication, these wonderful teardrop lugs, stainless steel case.
Which, it's awesome.
It's
so quintessentially Vacheron.
It's so quintessentially Vacheron, and it's so quintessentially the essence of what you really want in a Revival Prize. You want something that really respects the original design, but that has all of the, sort of convenience and quality associated with modern manufacturing processes and a modern support system. It's just a delectable watch.
Delectable.
Y'all.
Perfect. Mm. All right. Next up is our penultimate prize and my favorite prize of the night. It didn't go to a watch.
No.
It was the Special Jury Prize, which is kind of like the Lifetime Achievement Award, I guess, for the GPHG. And Aurel Box, our friend at Philips, comes out on stage and says to the moderator, I guess, to the MC for the evening, "Well, you said I only have 90 seconds, so I'm going to make this quick," and began rattling off words and catchphrases.
Possibly the best use of 90 seconds in any public speech since, Demosthenes in Athens.
And it's Aurel. So people are, again, people start to realize what's going on here and who's going to win this prize.
It's I have to say, it's a good thing Aurel doesn't want to be a political demagogue because, boy, oh boy.
Man. Yeah. Reminds me of that. Did you ever watch The Office, the American version of The Office?
I have to say, no. Alas, I didn't.
There's an episode where Dwight is giving a speech at a sales conference and basically gives this like Mussolini-style speech where he's banging on the table and talking about salesmen unite and people are cheering. And, it kind of reminded me of that in a funny way where, Aurel's like 10, 20 seconds into this.
Yeah.
And again, people are cheering and clapping and standing up and yelling at individual mentions of things. And
which partly had to do with the fact that by the time and this speaks to the skill with which he delivered the, his opening remarks, with, I would say, 15 seconds in, pretty much everybody knew who he was talking about.
Yeah. And that person was Jean-Claude Beaver. Who, as you probably know, recently kind of stepped into a more advisory role at LVMH, citing some health issues, amongst other things. And I have to say, Jean-Claude was there. He was looking good. He looked like he was healthy and doing well. Yep. And
he looked great.
He looked great. Sure. And he had a big smile on his face. Yeah. he cried on stage, which I've seen him get pretty emotional before. I've never seen him like this.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. It was a really, he got a standing ovation. He's the only person who got a standing ovation.
And a long standing ovation.
A long standing ovation. It was incredible. I mean, in a similar way to the response that Recep Tayyip got for the Acrivia win, this was a case where, like, whether you've worked for Jean-Claude or competed against him or just know him kind of casually, he's somebody who makes a big impression and really is in a lot of ways responsible for all of us being here and doing this.
Yeah, Jean-Claude Beaver is, he's one of those, he was one of the people who was really instrumental in driving the revival of mechanical watchmaking. And, you know, like Nicholas G. Hayek and, you know, a handful of other people, he's a big part of the reason that we're actually here in Geneva and able to have this conversation.
Completely.
You know.
Completely.
And he's a very, very complicated person. You know, he can be infuriating. He can be mercurial. He can be dictatorial. He can be unexpectedly, you know, kind and compassionate. You think he's the worst listener on earth and that he has no interest in anyone else's opinion. And suddenly he's like listening to you. You know,
and he repeats something back to you that you completely forgot you said.
Yeah,
but he's been listening closer than you've been
listening. And you know, and he can be a very, very hard man, and he can be a very, very soft, you know, soft-hearted individual. And I think that he is. This is one of the things that he talked about last night. You know, in his sort of thank you speech, he's very, very much aware of all of the different directions in which his, you know, personality has pulled him. You know, over the years. But the one, you could not find a person on earth who's more truly in love with and passionate about watchmaking. And I remember a conversation that I had with him a couple of years ago, you know, where he said the thing that scares him the most is how many people there are nowadays who are involved in the watchmaking industry who just don't care about watches. They could be in any other, you know, they have MBAs and they could be in pharma or banking, you know, or to them it's just another product. And he feels that this is not good for watchmaking. And boy, oh boy, is he not that person.
He is watchmaking,
yeah.
You know, through and through. And it really showed through last night. I have to say it was by far the most moving part of the ceremony.
It was great to be there.
It was. And I loved the way he finished the speech as he said that, you know, when he was in school, he remembered that he had a teacher.
Oh, this was hilarious.
Who told him, Beaver, you know, you're
hopeless.
You're hopeless. You're dumb and you're hopeless. And there are only two hopes for you. One, that your family's rich and you never have to work. Or that somebody makes you the boss and you can just hire people smarter than yourself.
Right.
And he said, I'm very lucky. I got to be the second. This award is for all of you. And he kind of bowed to the different directions of the crowd and graciously walked off stage. And it was really, really a nice kind of special moment where everybody could kind of come together at the end of the ceremony.
Yeah, you know, one of the criteria for the special jury award is that the person should, you know, still be with us, but no longer be active professionally. They should have retired, basically.
Right.
It's sort of a lifetime achievement award. But, you know, I don't know, Jean-Claude Beaver retiring, that's like, I remember Akira Kurosawa, you know, allegedly retired at one point, and he was like, yeah, I'm done, I'm never going to, I've said everything I need to say, and, you know, like 2 years later, you know, he came out with another, you know, sort of amazing film. And if you're driven by passion, you know, sort of saying to yourself, well, it's been a good run. Now I'm going to, you know, go and,
make cheese.
Know, yeah. And putter around in my garden and, you know, walk up the mountain with the cows once a year. I don't know. We'll see.
We'll see. I think we're going to see more of him, but, all right, we're here at the end, the last award, the Aigle d'Or, the grand prize for the night,
yep.
The best watch of the year, some would say.
Right, so Aigle d'Or means golden hand.
Right, and the statue is a very creepy, large golden hand. They really have to get better statues, but that's a whole separate conversation. But these awards are super creepy looking.
Yeah, actually, you know, the GPHG award, the Aigle d'Or, it kind of reminds me of the last scene in Terminator 2 when the Terminator's like, you know, sinking into that mass of, you know, molten steel, and he's like, you know, the last thing sticking out
like
is his
putting
hand.
One of these on my mantle, like it's just like ugh.
Yeah, you might feel differently if you were a watch brand and you just won one.
That's fair.
Yeah. In the hand, by the way, it's a very substantial award.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's good 6 or 7 pounds.
Oh wow. Yep. All right. See, this is why we have you here. You have the insider perspective.
Yeah.
So Jack, do you want to tell us which watch took home the biggest prize of the night?
So, L'Aiguille d'Or, the prize was given to the Beauvais Recital 22 Grand Recital. So nice they named it twice.
Yeah. Great.
I meant to ask Mr. I saw Mr. Raffi after the awards ceremony last night.
Mr. Raffi being the Pascal Raffi.
Yeah, he's the owner and founder of Beauvais.
Yeah.
Who's another one of these kind of like, fascinating, mercurial kind of, very, very strong-minded, independent-minded individuals that you see in the watch industry. And one of the very few who also has enough business acumen to, make his company a financial success as well.
Sure.
I meant to ask him about the name, and I just sort of forgot. This particular watch, there's a lot going on.
That might be the understatement of this podcast.
Yeah. So we have a retrograde perpetual calendar on the back, along with a star chart.
Love complications on the back that you can't use and that are completely useless.
And the basic layout of the watch is an orrery. Orrery is a term for a mechanical model of the solar system.
Right.
And the word orrery, it's actually somebody's name. There was an Earl of Orrery who ordered a famous orrery from someone who was making orreries before they were called orreries.
You've now used up that word.
I have. So his name is now, the Earl of Orrery's name is now associated with this complication. And it's a particular kind of orrery called a tellurium, which focuses on the relative positions of the moon, the earth, and the sun. And tellurium watches are pretty rare. I think Ulysse Nardin actually made the very first tellurium wristwatch ever in the mid-1990s as part of the Trilogy of Time. This one is pretty spectacular. So there's a one-minute tourbillon at the 6 o'clock position, which also indicates the position of the sun relative to the earth. There's a hemisphere showing the earth as seen from the northern hemisphere, just above the North Pole, which rotates once every 24 hours. Around it is a little moon, which shows the age and phase of the moon, and it shows where the moon is in its orbit relative to the earth and relative to the sun. There's a piece of information missing that you would need in order to tell whether there's an actual solar eclipse going on. So when the moon is positioned in between the sun and the earth, it has to be not only on the sort of same plane as the earth and the sun in order for there to be an eclipse happening someplace on earth. And because the moon's orbit is actually tilted slightly relative to the earth, you don't get an eclipse every time there's a new moon. But you can kind of, sort of make a guess at whether or not there's a possibility of an eclipse. And what else have we got? We've got a retrograde minutes display. We've got a power to the left. We've got a power reserve on the right. Just a phenomenally complex watch, just mechanically. And then you sort of look at the quality of the finishing, the quality of the execution. No points lost there, whatsoever. The steelwork is fantastic. The thing that obviously is the most compelling about the watch is this hand-painted hemisphere representing the earth. So this is actually done in several layers of what's called a cold enamel. So this is basically a thermosetting epoxy resin. It's not fired enamel. It's a different process, different material. There are several layers. There's a clear layer. There's the layer that represents the earth and the oceans. There's a layer above that clear coating layer. And within the clear coating layer, that's where the clouds that are a part of the display are situated. So they actually seem to be, the clouds actually seem to be floating above the surface of the earth.
Cool.
And there is Luminova pigment mixed in with the paints that were used for the earth. And when I was talking to Pascal Raffi about this watch afterwards, I found out something I didn't know, which is that getting the composition of the resin, nobody had ever tried to do this before with cold enamel. Mix luminous material.
Right.
With it, and getting it to the right consistency so they could apply it to the hemisphere without everything kind of, dripping and smearing. It took them 3 years to come up with the correct composition.
Nice.
So like just that part alone of the watch took 3 years to develop.
Cool.
We actually have some pictures on the site of this watch. We have some loom shots of this watch.
Yeah.
And it's quite a show.
It's one of those watches that personally does not speak to me at all, but from an objective standpoint, I can understand why something like this wins. Like, it is an achievement in watchmaking. It is an achievement in craft, in kind of the arts that make up the greater kind of watchmaking sphere, despite the fact that it's not something that interests me as a wristwatch at all.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, knowing what I do of your personal tastes, I would say that this is probably the most one of the most un-Stephen J. Pulverint watches
it's
in existence.
Pretty un-Stephen J. Pulverint. That's true. Yeah, I think, you know, for me, something like the Acrivia is, you know, something I would have maybe pushed for this for this category, because I do think it you know, ticks a lot of the same boxes.
And it would have been a logical thing to push for.
Yeah. But I think, you know, again, having seen this watch in the metal a few months back, there's no denying that this watch is an exceptional creation.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So we've gone through the awards. We've run very long. This is probably going to be one of the longer episodes of Hodinkee Radio. But something that I think is important to kind of wrap up with is, you know, if you look back at who's won the awards, you'll notice it's a lot of independent brands and very few sort of big group brands. And that's
correct
for a number of reasons.
Right.
If you look at the chatter on social media, a lot of folks are saying, oh, the independents are winning. You know, it's a win for independent watchmaking. And I think there's merit to that. I'm not saying that independent watchmakers are not doing exceptional things. They are completely. There are, though, a lack of entries from the larger group brands.
Yes.
You know, we've seen Swatch Group with a handful of exceptions. Longines is in a couple of categories. Other than that, Swatch Group has basically sat out, with the exception of Vacheron and one or two shortlisted watches from Montblanc.
Right.
Richemont has sat out. There's no Rolex. There is Tudor, but no Rolex.
Right. Right.
And there's no Patek, and there's no AP.
Yeah.
So it's a little hard to know how representative these awards actually are of broader watchmaking when Rolex, Patek, AP, most of Richemont, and most of Swatch Group are sitting out. I mean, no Omega, no Rolex, no Patek, no AP, no JLC, you know, no Cartier.
Right.
Like,
right.
That's a lot. I mean, what do you think that means?
It's 75% of the brands that we spend most of our time talking about.
Right.
Are not part of this process. So here's the challenge. On the brand side, you know, the question sort of is, well, why should we expose ourselves to, you know, the Patek Philippe's and Rolexes of the world? You know, at best, this is something that's not relevant to them commercially. And, you know, at worst, it's, you know, sort of, maybe a little bit cynical, but it's like, okay, why should we expose ourselves, you know, to the possibility of, you know, the negative PR that's associated with not winning a prize in competition with, you know, with some of these smaller guys, you know, just there's no perceived upside whatsoever, I think. Which is a little bit of a shame because, and I have to be frank, I think one of the things the Swiss watch industry does not do very well is kind of have an understanding that it has an obligation, cultural obligation, that transcends brand divisions, you know.
Right.
So, you know, there's a real tendency, I think, for management of the major luxury groups and, you know, for brand CEOs to kind of think of making watches as the zero-sum game where, you know, the only way I can win is if you know, somebody else is losing.
Right.
And I can understand that. I mean, you know, business can be very cutthroat. You know, you have to make a profit or you're not in business.
No question.
But it means that, you know, huge opportunities are missed to kind of present this really unique cultural heritage. I mean, you know, what the reason that, you know, Switzerland is the world center for, you know, for fine watchmaking and arguably for, you know, watchmaking, you know, period. You know, Japan being the other, you know, major center for making watches,
right,
you know, at this point. I mean, it's this is a fascinating country. The reason that watchmaking is here is for really fascinating historic reasons. And for the watch industry to sort of not support something that brings together brands across a lot of different divides, I think it's a shame. And, you know, one of the things that I would hope as a juror is I would hope to see more brands participating, you know, in coming years simply with the understanding that, you know, if there's no sense of this as a collective enterprise, I think it's going to be very bad for watchmaking.
I agree with you. I think, you know, the Grand Prix still has a pretty good reputation in the industry and amongst enthusiasts. I think if we get to a point where the kind of, you know, the players that make up, you know, 75-80% of the watches actually sold every year aren't participating,
right,
it gets really hard. I mean, that would be like the Oscars not including the 10 highest grossing films.
Right.
Like, you can't you can't have an award like that. Or, you know, if, like, you know, Beyonce didn't allow her record to be considered for the Grammys. Like, you you can't do that and have kind of a valid process. So I think it's,
you know,
it's
going to
be...
The Motion Picture Academy is in a different position because these are, you know, these are very, these are, a movie's a democratic, you know, product ultimately. And everybody gets to see a movie. So it means everybody gets to have an opinion.
Of course.
Ignoring what the, you know, Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, you know, has to say about your film means you look like a chicken. And I mean, you can, if you don't show up, it's and you're nominated, it's you know, it's presumably because you have, you know, sometimes it's because there's a political agenda. Sometimes, you know, you just can't make it for personal reasons. But in general, you know, it's a very, very different setup.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, people call the GPHG the Academy Awards of Watchmaking, but the analogy only, you know, it doesn't go that far.
Right. Especially because, I mean, you just said you cannot show up, but your product is still nominated,
yeah,
right?
Still,
like your film or your album or whatever.
Right.
Here, you have to actively submit.
That's right.
So, yeah, I wonder if there's a way to do this in a way where it's less optional.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, to you know, to some of the folks who, you know, who don't submit, I mean, you know, it would immeasurably enrich the entire process, and I think it would be good for watchmaking as a whole, for major brands to participate. But then, of course, that opens a whole other can of worms. So let's say, for example, that Rolex participates in the men's watch category. I mean, Rolex is a behemoth presence in the industry on a number of different levels, and I think there would be a sense that maybe it's not a... it would solve one problem, but it would create an argument that the playing field is not level, you know, on another level. And I think what this really all sort of boils down to is this is never going to be a perfect process. You know, the question for me as, you know, as a two-time participant is, you know, does it give exposure to some interesting watches? And I think the answer is yes. And does it create a conversation around those watches that raises points that are of general interest to the watchmaking community? And I think the answer to that is, well, I would love to see more of the bigger brands participate. And I think that it's everybody's loss, including those brands.
All right. So you heard it here first. If you're listening to this and you work at a brand that does not participate, please participate. It makes it better for all of us.
It's just more fun. It's
way more fun. It would be way more interesting if these fields, I think they would ultimately be more competitive also.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, gosh, I mean, you know, I'm scared of not winning, you know, because it's, you know, it's a negative PR event. Okay, fine. But it's like, don't you want to be part of an interesting conversation?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, the point to this whole thing is not, there were a ton of fabulous watches that didn't win a prize this year. But, you know, people enter year after year because they want to be part of an interesting conversation.
Yeah. Great. Well, I think this was a pretty interesting conversation, if I may say so myself.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for getting us up at, you know, what, relatively speaking, after the GPHG award ceremony is the crack of dawn for...
I would say so. The sun was up, but barely-ish. Yeah. Great. Well, this was fun, and congratulations again on your second year as juror. And
we're on to the watch events are far from over this weekend. We've got the auctions coming.
Yeah. The auctions start in, you know, just a couple hours, about 5 hours, five, 6 hours at Philips. So Jack and I will be there. By the time you hear this, you'll probably have already seen some of our reporting from Philips, and then Christie's and Sotheby's are Monday and Tuesday. Mr. Davide Parmigiani has an exhibition of rare watches going on at the Four Seasons that I think we're going to go check out.
There might be one or two cool things.
I think I might be able to get Jack to go over there to see some enamel dial Rolexes and Pateks.
Twist my arm.
Awesome. So thanks for doing this, Jack.
Thanks,
and thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks again to Jack for joining us. This week's episode was recorded at the Grand Hotel Kempinski in Geneva. It was produced by me, Stephen Pulverant, and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference for us. Thanks again, and see you next week.